meeting will come to order. First item on our agenda is the approval of introduction of committee bills. The first is LC 2422, proposed amendment to Oregon Constitution allowing judges to teach in public schools or other institutions of education. The matter was before us earlier as a proposal from various judges, I guess, who were impacted by that present restriction. The second is LC 1626, which directs appeals from justice in municipal courts to district court instead of circuit court and county having district court. And the third is from the Governor's Task Force on DUI, and this is the proposal that embodies their suggested amendments to the diversion program.
That would not fit within a bill currently in the package as an amendment?
It might, except the problem is without, at this point, until we get to that and maybe integrate as an amendment, refer it, endorse it, and bring it back, there's no public circulation of the thing. That's why I think it would be well to have it as a separate bill if we can get the speaker's approval. The chair would move the described LC drafts as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Objection? First item on our work session is House Bill 2891.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to... This is the bill by which the committee is having a chance to review the changes to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which were promulgated by the Council on Court Procedures. The changes, there's about a dozen changes, and all the bill does in its printed form is simply postpone the effective date of these amendments from 90 days after the end of the session to January 1, '84. As you'll remember, these amendments will become law unless the legislature vetoes them, essentially. Would you like me to quickly go through what all the changes are? They were all accepted by the subcommittee except for one of the changes, one of the rule changes.
Why don't you quickly describe it?
Okay. The first change would be an amendment of Rule 7D3, right now it has to do with service of process on a public body. It would change the rule to allow service on an attorney of the public body, but would not allow service on a public body clerk. And it also eliminates the present requirement that a duplicate copy of the summons be sent to the DA for the county. Rule 74 would be amended to provide that in motor vehicle cases, if a defendant's insurance carrier is known, the carrier has to receive a mailed copy of the summons and complaint, and the plaintiff has to certify that a copy was mailed to the insurance carrier or that the carrier is unknown. The idea of that being to simply make sure that the insurance carrier knows of active litigation. Rule 7F would be amended to allow, in those rare cases when service of process is made by mail, to allow the attorney for a party to file a certificate of service. Right now, because an attorney cannot, by the rules, an attorney for a party cannot serve process in the case. It has to be someone else. At present, the attorney can't fill out and sign a certificate of service for mailed service of process. Because mailed service of process does not involve questions of, you know, face-to-face encounters and was this really the defendant and so forth, this rule would simply allow in those rare cases where mail service of process is allowed, the attorney of the party can be essentially the process server by certifying that he put it in the mailbox. Rule 9 would be amended to allow service of pleadings and other papers on a party who has appeared in the case but who has not provided an address for service simply by placing a copy of the papers in the court file. And I believe this is to get in part to some of the sham and frivolous type claims where a party may appear but without an attorney and without providing an adequate address for serving of any papers. So this would simply say if there's no address, you can serve them by putting it in the court files. Rule 21 would be amended by adding a sentence to clarify that a court, when it grants a motion to dismiss for any of the various reasons, the court can allow leave to amend. This is no change from present law. The court right now has either discretion to allow leave to amend or discretion to dismiss with prejudice. But apparently some judges are clear about whether, when they dismiss, whether they can allow a party to amend the pleadings, and this would simply clarify that they could.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Courtney.
Move House Bill 2891 to the floor. Do pass.
Don't think we completed the... There is one provision apparently that's in dispute.
There's also a witness here at the committee. I'll stop going through all these if you'd like me just to go to the one that's in dispute.
Mr. Hall. Excuse me. Your Kirk Hall.
The one that was disputed was Rule 22C. That would, under present law for third-party practice, a defendant is required to file a third-party complaint within 10 days after filing of the original answer. This would have been changed under the proposed amendments here to shorten the time so that instead it had to be filed no later than 90 days after service of the plaintiff's original summons and complaint, whether or not the time for the defendant to file the answer had arisen. The idea was, and after that time, if a defendant wanted to file a third-party complaint later than 90 days after original service of the plaintiff's summons and complaint, the defendant would have to get agreement of the parties and leave of the court at that time. Now, we have a gentleman here, Jim Tate, who's going to speak in a moment about, on behalf of the Council on Court Procedures, why they wanted that change. I've spoken to Douglas Haldane, and the main idea, apparently the chief problem is that a lot of times you're well down the road. A plaintiff will give a defendant sort of an indefinite extension on filing the original answer. They'll go through a year of discovery, and then at that point, the defendant will file an answer and a third-party complaint, and the third-party defendant then says, well, I want to do all the discovery over again, and it can delay and cause duplication of effort. We have a letter which has been distributed to all nine members from Randy Foster opposing this change and mentioning that he had a case recently where he was defending, and through motions against the complaint, all of which were granted by the presiding judge, the plaintiff's complaint kept getting dismissed and amended because the plaintiff was never alleging causation. And I remember this case. The plaintiff said, all these things happen and you owe me a bunch of money, and there was no causation between no proper causation between the facts, the interactions between the parties, and the damages claimed. Finally, this particular plaintiff got up to the eighth amended complaint, and at that point, Judge Crookham said, I'm sorry, but eight times is enough, and the complaint was out. And that took a couple of cases. The complaint never was in a proper form, and no answer was ever due from the defendant in that case. And so this, relying on this example, Subcommittee 2 felt that it would not be proper to force a defendant to file a third-party complaint before the defendant was required to file the original answer in the case. That was the reason why, because you won't know who you need as a third-party defendant until you know exactly what the plaintiff's claims are against you. So the concern of the subcommittee was that there was no way that a defendant really could know who to bring in on a third-party complaint until all motions against the plaintiff's complaint, had been finally decided upon. And I might just mention that to the degree that the problem arises because the plaintiff has given an indefinite extension to the defendant in filing an answer, that's something within the plaintiff's power to control. Just don't give an indefinite extension. To the degree that it results from errors or problems in the plaintiff's original complaint, that too is in the plaintiff's control to get the complaint right the first time. So those were the reasons why Subcommittee 2 voted not to go with that change to Rule 22C. And Mr. Tate is here. The Council on Court Procedures asked for an opportunity to speak in favor of that rule change.
Tate.
I'll just take a couple of minutes here. First, if you don't already know it, third-party practice has probably been discussed by the Council on Court Procedures more times, and there have been more votes about third-party practice than anything else that we've ever dealt with. It's been, the debate has at times been bitter. There have been votes, re-votes, re-re-votes, mail votes, personal votes. it's gotten to the point that everybody on the council hates the subject to even come up. The vote has always been, will we keep third-party practice or will we abolish third-party practice? This is the first time since there's been third-party practice that there has been any attempt to modify how you go about doing it to make the system better. The complaint has always been, primarily by the judges and by the plaintiff's bar, that when you have third-party practice, it delays the case so long that it causes all kinds of expense, and it simply makes the whole matter unmanageable. The consensus on the council this year was to nail down the time in which you could file a third-party complaint. The council made this recommendation realizing the fault with this approach that's been brought out by the letter that was sent to this committee. That is, if there has been no answer filed, or if there's someone who hasn't been discovered as a potential third-party defendant, that you won't be able to potentially use this single procedure to answer all of the questions. The council felt that it was worth giving away those few cases to solve a much larger problem, which is delay in the courts. And in terms of fairness, there isn't any requirement that all of these things be litigated in one case. A defendant who can't bring in a third-party defendant within 90 days and can't after that hasn't lost anything. Under the procedures we have right now, he could file a separate action and ask that they be consolidated. He could wait until the original action is completed and file a separate action. So the defendant actually loses nothing except the procedural advantage of having everything all together at once. I don't really have anything else to say about it. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to respond to them.
Kurt? I would just ask one question under 22C right now. If the plaintiff believes that allowing in a third-party defendant will delay the case, right now it says any party may move to strike the third-party claim or for its severance or separate trial. So it's not as if a plaintiff is locked in now. The plaintiff can move to the court, and if the court agrees that the third-party claim will unduly delay the case, right now the court has power to sever that third-party claim.
There's no question the court has the power to do that. The problem you have is that the whole world doesn't operate with top-quality lawyers who are on top of all the procedures, and there are a lot of plaintiff's lawyers out there particularly who don't have the foggiest idea what they're doing when it comes to rules like this. And they can't understand why their case doesn't get to trial in 2 years. And part of it is that they don't understand that you can ask to have these things separated. They don't understand that you don't have to agree to a third-party complaint being filed, which could necessitate, by the way, if you've already gone through 2 years of discovery, which could necessitate doing all that over again. And the rules as we have them now, for example, depositions are only binding on those parties who were represented during the deposition and had notice and opportunity to be there. Obviously, somebody who's brought in as a third-party defendant after 2 years of discovery wasn't notified of any deposition, wasn't there, and is not bound by any of the questions or any of the answers, and has the right to go back and insist that all of that be done over again, or more likely can simply lay in the weeds, wait for a trial, and object to the use of any of those depositions. It's a complicated issue. This is the Council on Court Procedures solution to a problem that we agree is not perfect. But it's our belief that there is no perfect solution. If you're going to have third-party practice, that you ought to limit it some way, and this is the way they've come up with it.
Well, isn't it true that the only reason why a third-party complaint would be filed well down the road, the present rule says within 10 days of filing the original answer, and the original answer is due 30 days after service of the original complaint. So we're really talking about 40 days after the lawsuit starts, the defendant is supposed to do the third party complaint. So isn't the only reason why this could happen, this could be shoved years down the road, is either because the plaintiff gave an open-ended extension to the defendant or because there are motions against the plaintiff's complaint. Is there any other reason why, and both of which I would consider to be within the control of the plaintiff's attorney, is there any other reason why this delay would occur?
No. I might point out, it's also the belief of the council that in almost every case, that may be a little bit too strong, but in most cases, anybody who's sued will know when they're sued of the existence of potential third-party defendants. And if they don't know, the time for filing a third-party complaint to their answer won't help at all. They'll only find out through discovery. In most cases, there have already been settlement negotiations, there have been dialogue between the plaintiff either the principals or the lawyers involved, and in most cases, you already know when you get a copy of a summons and complaint that there are potential third-party defense out there, and in most cases, you'll know who they are. So the magic time of the filing of your answer really doesn't mean anything. The filing of the answer was simply a date that was originally picked without any particular reason. If you were really concerned about having all of the everything known about the case, you would say until after discovery was done, which would make this the whole third-party practice concept totally unworkable.
My last but the rule doesn't say that right now. It really, unless it gets delayed for some reason that it contemplates it within 40 days of the start of the lawsuit. But would this rule change that you're recommending here contemplate a third-party complaint being filed before the answer was filed?
Could be.
I just don't see how would that even work from a pleading standpoint. How could a defendant file a third-party complaint without ever having answered the original complaint?
Well,
aren't the two tied together
No, there's no rule now that requires the filing of an answer by a defendant before they file a third-party complaint. And as a matter of fact, it makes more sense to do it the other way around, because when you file a third-party complaint, the third-party defendant, under the present rules, is authorized to answer the complaint as well as the third-party complaint. So there isn't any prohibition now from a defendant who knows who the people are out there that he wants to bring them in and going ahead with his motion practice.
Except the defendant is not really going to know what charges or claims are made against the defendant until the complaint is in final form. So I just don't see, basically a defendant would have to say, it is anticipated that defendant will be subject to these claims, and if so, I wonder if that would even stand under some of the pleading rules.
Well, ordinarily, if you have a complaint that's been filed against you, it has the allegations. If it's a negligent complaint, for example, it says you were negligent in doing A, B, C, and D. And a third-party complaint for contribution ordinarily simply says that he did it too, and if we're found responsible, so should he. I don't find this as a particularly difficult pleading question. Really, the biggest problem addressed by this proposed change is the delay problem. And in the real world out there, there aren't very many people who file an answer within 30 days. It just doesn't happen. I routinely get on the telephone and call the plaintiff's lawyer and say, I don't have any file materials yet. I know that there's some coming, but I don't have any file materials yet. Can I get an extension? And if everything works perfectly, I get all those things and make an appearance within 30 days, but lots of time things get lost, and it takes a lot longer than 30 days. But my experience as a defense lawyer is that usually I know who I'm going to bring in as a third-party defendant if I'm going to use that practice at all with the first arrival of the first materials.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Tate, for coming down.
We haven't dealt with that. Yeah. Are we going to?
Unless there are questions from the subcommittee dealing with any other of the provisions of the subcommittee's action, I guess the only issue we really need to resolve is whether the committee will endorse the amendment, the subcommittee's amendment to the proposed amendments, not proposed, the promulgated amendments to reverse the decision of the council dealing with the modification of third-party practice, or whether we're going to restore that amendment and simply report a bill which would delay the effective date of all of the changes until January 1.
There are two other pending matters when you finish with that issue. There's the bill we're going to fold into this bill and the rule change that Representative Smith has proposed. I did just wanted to remind you before a final vote is taken on this bill.
Right. Well, the matter is open for discussion on the committee. Let me just put it to you. Is there a motion to reinstate, to amend the subcommittee's recommendation by reinstating the council's promulgated rule change on third-party practice?
I left before they got to that in the subcommittee, so I didn't have a move to the subcommittee decision.
What are the other two issues?
The other two issues are simply folding in 2888, which is a Rule 54E change, and also a possible change to Rule 7 on service by mail.
You want to read 2888?
Okay. 2888 came from the Oregon State Bar Practice and Procedure section. It would make two fairly minor changes in Rule 54E, which is the rule by which a defendant on a particular claim can make an offer of compromise. Right now, they can make the offer anytime up to 3 days prior to trial. If the other party, generally the plaintiff, refuses the offer of compromise but does not do better at trial, that party will not recover cost disbursements and attorney's fees incurred after the date of the offer. And the other party who made the rejected offer will recover costs and disbursements from the time of the offer. It's like a slight hammer over the head of somebody to accept a reasonable offer. The changes in the bill would change the time by which you had to make the offer from 3 days prior to trial to 10 days prior to trial. The testimony was that most of the work and a lot of the cost involved in going to trial happened in the last 10 days, and if this is to have any effect at all in terms of saving the party's costs and whatnot, the offer should have to be made at least 10 days prior to trial. The defendant shouldn't be able to wait until 3 days prior to trial to make the offer. Well, and I guess it would just have a beneficial effect both ways. The other change is to clarify that right now it says, unless agreed upon by the parties, cost disbursements and attorney's fees will be entered as part of the judgment under Rule 68. The practice has been that those things will be added on top of the offer. So, for instance, if you say, I accept your offer, then you go to a Rule 68-type hearing where the court says, okay, in addition to that, you get costs and disbursements, and if you've got a contract or if the statute authorizes it, you also get attorney's fees. If you get attorney's fees, if you would have gotten attorney's fees for winning, and you don't get attorney's fees otherwise, this simply clarifies that those things are added on top of the offer unless the party making the offer says this is inclusive of cost disbursements and attorney's fees. So it's still in control of the party making the offer. This clarifies what happens if just a lump sum dollar figure is named without any specific agreement as to whether it does or doesn't include costs and disbursements and attorney's fees in appropriate cases. A letter, which I think has been distributed also from Randy Foster on this rule, suggested two other changes. One, to apparently there's a Supreme Court case on a similar federal rule that says basically if you make an offer, it's rejected, and then you win a trial, you don't get any of the benefits under the rule. You don't get costs of disbursements under the federal rule, which is just crazy because, in other words, you're in a better position there to lose a trial, but lose by an amount less than the offer you made. So initially he was saying, how about a change to clarify that? But in talking to Diana Godwin, who spoke with some people in the pleading and practice section, they said there really shouldn't be any need for that kind of change because if you win a trial, if you made an offer and you win a trial, you get costs and disbursements anyway. So you wouldn't come under the rule, you wouldn't need the rule. And I think that's probably right. The other change he suggested was making it reciprocal on this attorney's fees thing. So, for instance, if you had a contract case where the prevailing party got attorney's fees, the defendant made an offer, plaintiff rejected the offer, Mr. Foster suggested that attorney's fees, which previously had been accruing on behalf of the plaintiff, would stop accruing on behalf of the plaintiff, and that's how it is under present law, but would start accruing on behalf of the defendant from that point until trial, assuming that the plaintiff didn't do any better at trial than in the offer. And this would be a reasonably substantive change, because right now a plaintiff has no real liability in turning down an offer that he doesn't do better on later. He simply loses his right to any additional attorney's fees, but he doesn't have much liability toward the defendant. Diana Godwin talked to three members of the practice and procedure section, and they felt that it was a big enough change and controversial enough that they would recommend not doing it in this bill and simply having them consider it for a later bill at a later date. So if the committee goes with those recommendations, they would simply, subcommittee simply voted out 2888, I believe, just a due pass. Yes. All right. A due pass with a change of the effective date to January 1 of 84.
First of all, was the subcommittee's intention, did the subcommittee discuss merging this bill into the 2891?
I don't believe they did, no.
I don't think I see any problem with that. However, I would assume, question I guess would then be, would we intend that the effective date of this amendment would also be?
The subcommittee did vote for that, to make the effective date January 1.
Then we'll have to have developed, beyond conceptual action here, a revision of the present language dealing with effective date in 2891, because it speaks only to the rules changes promulgated by the council. This was submitted separately, so I understand.
Yes.
Would it be just as well, Mr. Chairman, if, assuming that the first bill is going out, why not just send the second one out separately? It requires less work of staff, it flies on its own, but it'd probably come up. We ask for it to be scheduled immediately adjacent to the other bill.
I have no problem. I assume 2888, well, 2888 was amended in subcommittee to provide for the January 1 effective date.
We did change it. Yes, it was amended to, so it would go out as a due pass as amended, because it would have a different, an effective date of January 1. The printed bill has no effective date. The subcommittee voted to make the effective date January 1, 1984, so it would go out up here as due pass as amended.
I'm just turning over my mind briefly before we vote whether simply providing for a January 1 effective date as to 2888 is there any question as to the effect that, you know, the hiatus there, how that.
So make it effective.
I see an issue will arise no matter what the effective date, but I guess I'm wondering if the description of the effective date needs to be further
actions commenced.
Elaborated as to what is and what is not subject to this provision. Because since we're rolling the date back rather than advancing it, I think it's important to be clear on that.
So whether or not it would be effective to pending cases, whether or not it would apply to pending cases which were pending on January 1, 1984?
That might be the simplest approach.
I think your choice would be either
to make it filed.
Cases, well, we had another bill, cases filed after that date versus all cases, including ones pending. I would think on this you really could go either way, simply because, well, there could be
some pending cases, though, which on January 1 were closer than 10 days to the date of trial, so maybe it would be simpler just to go with cases filed.
Uh-huh.
Chair would so move. Is there any objection? Okay. Is there a motion on 2891? Oh, no, we have the one there, Sean. I'm sorry.
Okay, then the last thing was on rule. Representative Smith raised the issue, which was raised for him, that service by mail is allowed in certain narrow cases. Right now, the rule at 7B2B says service by mail, when required or allowed by this rule, shall be made by mailing a true copy and so forth by certified or registered mail, return receipt requested. And I spoke to the post office. They're never very clear when you ask them about these things, but I believe it's the return receipt requested part that's a problem. Many defendants simply refuse to sign. When a mailman comes with a letter from a law firm and they want the signature of somebody, they don't want to sign, and so you can't get effective service that way. The suggestion from the person who contacted Representative Smith was to do away with the requirement that the defendant have to sign anything. I think that could be accomplished by taking out the language return receipt requested. And then I raised to Representative Smith as a policy issue, the committee should decide whether that would in fact, you would then, I think, be relying on a note from the mailman or something saying I gave it to somebody. I don't think they'd be able to say who the person was at this address, or it was delivered to a person at this address. That would be the only kind of response you would get back in the file and for the court to look at. So I think it is a policy question whether that is going to be good enough for a court to decide whether effective service was made.
Are there any other bills in the subcommittee which that issue strikes me as one that maybe the subcommittee ought to think out a little bit more, Representative Smith. I'm wondering if you have any objection if we have another vehicle in the subcommittee that maybe we take that up as a perhaps still further amendment.
2888, unfortunately, offers
the idea.
but it's got the wrong relating clause. We do have Representative Otto's bill, service on the wrong person, which right now would be a problem with relating clause.
Why don't we take 2888, go back to Plan A, put 2888 into 2891, and hold 2888 as a vehicle?
As a vehicle. Or any other relating clauses on 2888.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right.
But Representative Otto, I think Representative Otto's bill, which the committee tentatively has decided not to handle in that form, they're going to be handling it in another form, in another bill, could be a vehicle. Now, whether he would object to the use of his bill as a vehicle for this, I don't know.
I would doubt it.
And then we have a couple Administration of Justice bills, including the sort of omnibus one, so probably it could go in there.
That's fine. It's not something to be very old, but I've been tracking this as a probable vehicle, and I'm not burning for it.
If you have no objection, I'd like to handle it that way.
That's fine.
And we can confer later about scheduling a consideration of it in the subcommittee. Anything further on either of these two bills? Anything else from the committee? Okay, is there a motion on 2891?
Mr. Chairman, I'm clear on 2891, then, whether we are adopting the Council on Court Procedures position on third-party practice, or whether I missed that portion of the subcommittee.